Well, I want to welcome you to our workshop on Rethinking Youth Ministry for Sustainable Growth. I appreciate you being here. I look forward to us having a fruitful discussion together. If you're here in this workshop, it tells me a few things, I think, immediately. One, either you forgot that the exhibit hall opens at 3 p.m., or you care enough about this that you came here out of your own free will. It tells me, I think, that you have a great concern for those that are part of this next generation and care about the church and that you desire to see the church grow. It tells me that you have a concern for those that are dropping out of the church as they graduate. It seems that there's this perennial problem of teenagers as they graduate from high school, as they go on to college and things like that, that they drop out of the youth ministry and they don't continue on into regular church. And so we want to talk about that. We want to think about what we can do and maybe try to find some solutions along the way. To begin, let's be really clear. Young people are leaving the church. Now, statistics vary fairly widely on this, but it's true that young people are leaving the church, and they're leaving the church, I think, in significant ways. So what I want to do with the first half of this workshop is to evaluate some statistics, look at why some people are saying that youth are leaving the church. Now, look at the rise of what we call the rise of the nuns or the non-religious in our culture. And then with the second half of the workshop, try to offer some solutions. And hopefully at the end here, we'll have some time for questions that maybe we can brainstorm a little bit together to think through these things together. So first, we have the nuns. If you don't know what the nuns are, don't be confused. We're not talking about a monastery, right? Not N-U-N's. The non-religious. So according to a Pew Research in 2014, nun is a term to refer to people who self-identify as atheists or agnostics, but more predominantly, when you hear people refer to the nuns, they're talking about those that subscribe to, quote, nothing in particular. They're just none, right? Non-religious. They don't believe in anything explicitly, which now makes up roughly 23% of the U.S. population. 23%. Now, here in a moment, we'll discuss this group a little bit more, but I want you to point you to a few things that might really surprise you about this group. I think it can be easy for us when we hear a term like that to kind of ascribe a certain caricature to it or assume certain things about that group, but I want us to try to look at some of the data surrounding the nuns. So some statistical information concerning this demographic. First, this group is growing quite rapidly. Again, according to a Pew Research study, the number of Americans who do not identify with any religion continues to grow at a rapid pace. One-fifth of the U.S. public and a third of adults under 30 are religiously unaffiliated. So right in the last 5 years alone, the unaffiliated have increased from just over 15% to just under 20%. So one-fifth of the U.S. population. The ranks now include more than 13 million self-described atheists and agnostics, which is nearly 6% of the U.S. public, as well as nearly 33 million who say they have no particular religious affiliation. So another 14%. So again, 20% is either atheist, agnostic, or non-religious at all. I don't want to take too much time on this right now, but a significant point of this demographic is that they're not looking for religion to practice. They're not really interested at all in an organized religion. They are, it seems, intentionally non-religious. It's not just happenstance that they say, I don't really care, I don't want it, I can take it or leave it, but they intentionally do not want to be part of an organized religion. Pew Research, again, two-thirds of them say they believe in God. Again, this is kind of maybe breaking some misconceptions here. Two-thirds of them say they believe in God. 68%, right? But they're non-religious. More than half say that they feel a deep connection with nature or the earth, 58%. More than a third classify themselves as spiritual, but not religious. You'll hear probably that term quite a bit, right? I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. And one in five, 21%, say they pray every single day. In addition, most religiously unaffiliated Americans think that church and other religious institutions benefit society. They think it's a good thing. They think churches and other religious institutions strengthen community bonds and they aid the poor. So they're not anti-religion. They just don't want to be part of it themselves. So with few exceptions, the unaffiliated say they are not looking for religion that would be right for them. Overwhelmingly, They think that religious organizations are too concerned with money and power, or they're too focused on rules or too involved in politics. Another graph for you here. What's especially important, I think, here is our next graph. So you have millennials, Gen Zs, who are much more likely to be part of this group, right? You see that section off to the left that makes up the unaffiliated. And as you go younger and younger, that group starts to get larger and larger. What's important, though, is you start to have what we call a generational replacement, right? So as the 65 plus drops off, you have another generation come along. If those trends continue, right, that group only gets larger and larger at a higher rate. So a third of adults under 30 have no religious affiliation, compared with just 1 in 10 who are 65 and older, right? A much larger percentage. And so you can see how big of a difference that makes between generations. As one generation drops off, another one comes in, and it seems like a larger percentage. Now, I do want to mention this. I don't know that they stay the same. So it can be as millennials get older or boomers get older and so on that those percentages decrease. It can be that, this is something that we can brainstorm later, it can be that as people get older, they might find a reason to get back into church or a reason to believe, although maybe the opposite could happen as well. So it's interesting to see how those numbers might change over time. We need to be careful, though. Before we blame the next generation for all of the problems, we should note this problem is across the board. It's not just millennials leaving the church. It's all people. Whether married or single, rich or poor, young or old, living in the West or the Bible Belt, almost every demographic group has seen a significant drop in people who call themselves Christians. So before we want to point maybe specifically to a certain geographical area, a certain type of person, it's pretty consistent across all different types of demographics. As a side note, I'd like to mention the drops have been deepest among two of the country's most formidable faith traditions. Catholics and mainline Protestants or liberal Protestants have seen the biggest decrease. Not a huge decrease, but about 3% over that period of time. At the same time, Hinduism and Islam have seen just a slight increase, a little over 1%. And the number of evangelicals has decreased, but very, very slowly, right? You see that 0.9% there. So for the most part, evangelicals have just kind of stayed the same. So what's changed significantly is the rise of the unaffiliated, right? You see that red line there. Just skyrocketed compared to the others on the list. All right, so let's break up some misconceptions. What are some things that you might find interesting about this group of nuns? First, they are mostly not atheists. Mostly not atheists. Nearly 80% of nuns were raised in a home with at least some nominal religious identification or affiliation, and a majority, 65%, say that religion remains important to them. Right, so they still think spiritual things are important. So a huge percentage is not atheistic, right? They don't reject everything supernatural. And so again, you'll hear them say things like, I'm spiritual, I'm just not religious, right? So they still want some connection with a god or gods or something like that. Number two, they are looking not for religion, but they are looking for community. Looking for community. We already looked at it, but researchers asked them this question. They said, quote, are you looking for a religion that would be right for you? Right? They're not trying to load the question, right? They're not trying to lead in a certain way. They're just saying, if there were a religion, any type of religion right for you, were you looking for it? And a commanding majority of 88% said not so much. They're not really interested in religion. The incredibly complex part of this is that this group is largely okay with not settling for one religious experience. So a little bit of this can just be a bit of a smorgasbord, right? They take maybe one practice of religion over here, a little bit from this over here, over there, and they kind of bring it all together in some kind of amalgamation that doesn't necessarily fit together. They may try all sorts of different experiences and be fine with it. A lot of it might have to do with personal fulfillment, right, or what feels right. In some ways, it can be kind of hedonistic, which challenges us, but we'll come back to that here in a moment. Also, a lack of faith can be tied to a lack of familiarity and fluency within one's faith tradition. A lot of good resources have been written on this. I would encourage you to check out a book called Souls in Transition by Christian Smith and Melissa Lindquist. Also, another book called Almost Christian by Kenda Creasy Dean. We'll talk about those here in a moment. It seems a huge problem with this, something that we're going to try to sink our teeth into here in a moment, is a lot of those that have walked away from the faith really had no fluency, right? They weren't able to speak the language. They weren't really grounded in their faith. They didn't have ownership of it. And so when they walked away from it, they really weren't rooted in it to begin with. So we'll mention that here in a moment. I mentioned to you this book, Soul Searching, Christian Smith and Melissa Lindquist. This and the other book, take these with a grain of salt. I don't agree with everything in them, but I think they're helpful in trying to assess the problem. So some of their critiques are good. Maybe some of their solutions aren't as great. So Christian Smith says this in his book. He says, the majority of teenagers are incredibly inarticulate about their faith, religious beliefs and practices, and its place in their lives. For you, I would encourage you to do this on your own. Come up with just a handful of beliefs. Maybe go through like the Free Will Baptist Treatise. Write up some simple questions and have your teenagers take a survey. Make it anonymous. Don't put them on the spot. Don't grade it for them, okay? but maybe take a survey and then look at it and see how they answer on maybe like some fundamental questions. Ask questions about the Trinity or the resurrection, about the inerrancy of Scripture. I bet you, and feel free to email me if this is contrary to what you find, I bet the biggest disparity will be on ethical questions. So if you ask questions about sexual practices, about gender, things like that. But also, they'll probably answer, yes, I believe the Bible's true over here. And then when you ask a question about ethics that the Bible's clear about over here, that those things are in conflict with one another. But again, I would encourage you to maybe ask some questions of your teenagers and see how they land on this. So the majority of teenagers are incredibly inarticulate about their faith, religious beliefs and practices, and its place in their lives. The de facto dominant religion among contemporary U.S. teenagers is, and this is Christian Smith, he coined this term, you might have heard it before, is moralistic therapeutic deism. Moralistic therapeutic deism. All right, so you might be asking, what is moralistic therapeutic deism? He says, when you boil down the religion of teenagers in the U.S., and he says, even if you go to Buddhists or Hindus, or you go to Jehovah's Witness or Mormons, this is kind of basically what you find. Let me give you the five main tenets. And as you listen to these, you might think, at first, these aren't all that bad. And as it goes along, you'll see how it gets worse. First, a God exists who created and orders the world and watches over human life on earth. So far, so good. God wants people to be good, nice, and fair to each other, as taught in the Bible and by most world religions. Okay. The central goal of life is to be happy and to feel good about oneself. Not so much. God does not need to be particularly involved in one's life except when he is needed to resolve a problem. And number five, good people go to heaven when they die. We got some problems here, right? Yes, God exists. He created and orders the world. He watches over human life. He does want us to pursue righteousness and holiness, but the central goal of my life or your life is not to feel good about myself or to be happy. That might be a byproduct of the gospel, right? But my entire life is centered on the glory of God. And God does, especially number four, right? God does not need to be particularly involved in one's life except when he is needed to resolve a problem. That's why some people have talked about moralistic therapeutic deism as treating God as a divine butler, or maybe even better yet, a divine therapist, right? I call on him when I have a problem, that therapeutic part, but otherwise he's removed, right? He's deistic, he's away. And so I call on him when I need him, but he is gone when I don't need him. And as long as I'm a good person, I go to heaven when I die. Right, all sorts of problems with this, but I think you'll find that many teenagers express many of these same tenets that are listed here. Ken DeCreasy Dean did a follow-up on this. So all of that, moralistic therapeutic deism, the soul-searching book, is a summary of Christian Smith's National Study of Youth and Religion he did through Notre Dame. There's a whole lot of findings. He did it maybe 2 decades ago now, but people are still kind of wrestling with the findings there. Ken DeCreasy Dean writes this book called Almost Christian, where she takes the findings of Christian Smith's study and she makes some conclusions about it and some observations as well. But she says this in the book, and I find this to be compelling. She says, if teenagers lack an articulate faith, right, if they're unable to articulate what they believe and why they believe it, it may be because the faith we show them is too spineless to merit much in the way of conversation. I mean, you see what she's saying, right? That we don't have anything substantive enough for them to believe in. Maybe what we've given them is things that aren't all that great. It's too shallow. It's not enough. they need something better, something stronger, something with a little spine to it. To put it another way, maybe young people are leaving the church because they don't have something of substance to believe in. Maybe they're leaving the church because they don't find Christianity compelling enough. LifeWay and Ligonier, almost yearly, they do this state of theology where they do a survey of different groups and they try to seek to kind of get an idea of what people believe in the United States across different demographics. And they found on almost every answer offered related to theological beliefs, almost every question related to theological ideas, young people between the ages of 18 and 34 consistently held heretical views at a higher rate than older respondents. Right, so younger age was more inclined to believe in things contrary to Scripture. Young people who identify themselves as Christians are far more likely to hold views that just simply aren't Christian. So we started to put this together. These young people aren't being taught by their parents or those around them to articulate their faith in a way that makes sense. These young people aren't finding a faith that, quote, turns the world upside down, as the book of Acts tells us. And when it comes to their beliefs, they're responding in ways that are contrary to biblical truth. So we find ourselves in quite a difficult position. They're not looking for a religion that would be right for them, right? They've already expressed that. And overwhelmingly, they think religious organizations are too concerned with things like money, power, politics, rules, and so on. In David Kimmon's book, You Lost Me, he says this. He says, youth find the church to be these six following things. And I think we can all see where they come away with a few of these, and we'll comment on a few of them as we go through. He says many of them find the church to be overprotective. The church is seen as a creativity killer, where risk-taking and being involved in culture are looked down upon. Number two, they see the church to be shallow. I think this is probably the predominant view if you read through Kinman's book, but he says the most common perception of the church is that they are boring. Easy platitudes, proof texting, formulaic slogans, etc. There's no mention of the gravity and power and depth of following Jesus Christ. Number three, they believe the church to be anti-science. Most have come to the conclusion that faith and science are incompatible with one another, which is an incredible misconception. They believe the church to be repressive, especially when it comes to sexual norms, right? That we want to repress certain sexual ideas. Well, that certainly might be true in some cases. That the church is exclusive, right? Christianity's claim to exclusivity is a hard sell. About that one, we can't do much about, right? The scripture's pretty clear, but we can make it a compelling case to believe in Christianity. And then lastly, doubtless, that young Christians say that the church is not a place that allows for them to express doubts or honest questions, and that's certainly a problem as well. So again, we start to put this together. Young people are not leaving, I don't think, because of style or cultural variables, but because of lack of depth and of substance, a lack of authenticity, lack of intergenerational mentoring, the absence of honest answers to tough intellectual questions. So here's the question. What do we do? How do we build a youth ministry for sustainable growth, right? We see all these major problems that we talked about. We're concerned about these, right? We don't want to see teens and young adults continue to leave the church. We want them to continue in the church, and we want to see our youth ministries grow even now. So what can we do about it? Well, let's start here. Pew Research reports that only 11% of young adults left the faith, said that they had a strong faith as a child. What's the point? It's this, that we're not losing anyone who wasn't already lost when they were younger. What I mean by that is that they weren't really grounded, rooted, part of the Christian community of their church as a child. And so many of those that left really weren't connected all that well to begin with. So one of the first things that we can do is to reach out, right? Build strong relationships, bring people into the fold of the Christian community, love them, care for them, help them grow in that strong faith together. Christian Smith, again, he notes this. He makes a point about this. He says, it is not a true sea change from seriously religious to unbelieving. So he says, with this rise of the nuns, it's not like you're seeing people that knew their Bibles deeply, that they knew their theology deeply and all that, and they just simply walked away. He says, really what you have is people that were very shallow in their faith to begin with and just simply walked away because they weren't connected. So he says it might actually helpfully clarify where people really stand, where we're really at. He says, still behind all of this is a longer-term distancing of some from any association with religious faith and practice, which is significant. An article I found back in 2013 by Larry Towne, he went and interviewed a handful of young atheists. And really was just asking the question, what was the major reason for your atheism? Why did you walk away from the faith, and why did you decide to become an atheist? And he found all of these different similarities or consistent themes throughout all of them, and I think some of them are worth noting here. He says many of them, majority of them, had attended church at one time. A lot of them communicated that the mission and the message of their individual churches was vague. They really weren't entirely sure what the purpose of going to church was for. This sounds familiar, right? We've already covered this, that they felt their churches offered superficial answers to life's difficult questions. Pair that with number four, I found this really intriguing. He says they expressed their deep respect for youth pastors and pastors who took the Bible seriously. Actually, if you go and look up this article, he records a lot of quotes from different ones that said they still deeply respect, even though they don't believe it anymore, deeply respect that youth pastor that wanted to walk through the Bible with them, talk about the scriptures, that focus more on the scriptures than other things. Ages 14 to 17 were decisive. Right? Those were kind of the turning point for many of them. The decision to embrace unbelief was often an emotional one, contrary to what you might hear from other people. It wasn't maybe this reasoned, logical belief. After all, they're 14 to 17 years old, right? Chances are they're not thinking very logically and reasonably through this. So it was an emotional one. Maybe they went through a hard time, a difficult time. Maybe something happened in their life, and so it was an emotional one. And then lastly, and I find this interesting, is that the internet factored heavily into their conversion to atheism. Actually, and I don't entirely know what the best way to combat this is, but he said one of the things that he found is when these teenagers would ask questions of their parents and their youth pastors about hard questions, right? Why does evil exist? Why doesn't God stop bad things from happening? So on. That when they felt like they didn't get a good answer from their church or from their parents, they just simply hopped on YouTube, they did a quick search, they're finding, you know, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, whoever, gives them a quick answer, and all of a sudden they feel like they have answered the question. And so the internet very much factored very heavily into all of this. All right, so we come back to David Kinnaman, who did the study of young people as well. And after studying all this information, he came to one conclusion. He writes this. And you can, I quote this often. He says, after countless interviews and conversations, I am convinced that historic and traditional practices and orthodox and wisdom-laden ways of believing are what the next generation really needs. See what he's saying there? Put it another way, he says, after talking to all these people, looking at all the data, having all of these interviews and conversations, I've come away and I've come to this conclusion that we should teach Christianity as Christianity, right? To simply do it the way that we've historically done it. Talk about the cost of discipleship. Talk about the radical way of following after Christ, right? Allow it to be the earth-shattering, compelling, glorious thing that it actually is. And stop trying to make it something that it's not. The question is, what are those historic and traditional practices? Let me give you six real quick action steps that I think can tie us to those historical practices and that we can start doing pretty quickly today. Number one, and maybe this is a little biographical, this is compelling to me as some of those saved out of a nominal Christian household and my siblings aren't saved. This is what really kind of has kept me in and has kept me continuing the faith, and it's this. Engage with their questions. Deal with people. Give them honest answers to honest questions. All right, so when that teenager asks questions about sexuality, about the age of the earth, about evil, about science, whatever it is, deal with them as honestly and as authentically and as compassionately as you can. Speak honestly about faith and life. I think sometimes we can give the impression that there are spiritual superheroes in the church, right? We have it all together, and you just kind of need to be like me. But That's not how it is, right? We struggle. We're being sanctified. We're growing in the Lord. And so be honest about your own faith in your life. Talk about your struggles. Talk about your successes. Talk to them about your own spiritual practices. And so just try to be as honest about faith and life as you can. Don't overpromise what Christianity can give. Part of that's because Christianity gives everything, right? It gives infinite glory in Christ. And so we don't have to overpromise about it, but tell them, right? It isn't going to fix all of these maybe earthly problems that you have now, but it gives greater and complete satisfaction in eternity. Promote deeper teaching. I don't know how many youth pastors I've heard say this, but it's simply true, right? Teenagers in high school are learning things like chemistry and algebra, right? They're reading these great works of literature. When they come to church, we don't have to water it down, right? They can handle the deep stuff. Now, that doesn't mean we have to make it boring, okay? don't make it like algebra, all right? I did not like math or science when I was in high school. But I remember I had an English teacher that took these great works of literature, and he just made them come alive. And we were diving deep into all these great books. And for a time there, I was like, I want to be an English teacher because I love my English teacher so much. He just really made this compelling for me. But he didn't water it down, right? He took us deep. We really wrestled with these ideas and these themes in this book. And so you can do the same thing in your teaching. Promote deeper teaching with your youth group. Encourage a holistic Christian worldview. We can call it the Sunday to Monday gap, right? We have, a lot of times we think that church and Christianity is what I do on Sunday. I tithe, I worship, I pray, and then there's a gap and there's Monday, right? And I live out my life until Saturday, and then I come back to church the next Sunday. Now, Christianity is for all of life, right? It's a holistic Christian worldview. And so show your teenagers how believing in Christ and following the Christian way applies to every facet of their life. It affects the way in which they relate with their family. It affects how they think about education, about jobs. Affects the way about their future family, about politics, all of these things, right? So show how it connects to everything. Develop substantive intergenerational relationships and community, right? Get them connected with other people in your church. And then lastly, reject market-driven ecclesiology. Reject things that smack too much of putting a slogan on something and selling it. One of the things I think we've seen over and over again through these statistics is that these teenagers want things that are authentic, right? They want things that are real, that are sincere. And if we're trying to pitch something to them or to try to do like a switch, bait and switch, I think we're going to fail every time. If you're wondering about that, let me give you some infographics here real quick. You may have heard it said that you need to make things look cool for your teenagers. I don't know who told you that. I don't think that they're right. I think authenticity is better than cool among teenagers. Looking at these graphics, so this was done through the Barna Group. You have four different pictures of sanctuaries here, and the millennials were just asked, point to the one that you would like to worship in, right? Which one appeals to you the most? The one that we would maybe think is the coolest, right? The kind of the megachurch over on the left is only 18%. And then there's one that's just kind of regular, nothing super special about on the right side is another 18%. The two in the middle, you have 44% of this auditorium with really no bells and whistles. It's just as it is. And then a very kind of high church liturgy one right there in the yellow is 20%. So that kind of goes against a little bit what we might think about these things. We'll drive the point home a little bit more. Select the word that describes your ideal church. Now, you can't read those back there, so let me read these for you. Picking between community and privacy, 78% for community, 22% for privacy. Choosing between the word sanctuary and auditorium, 77% preferred sanctuary over auditorium. Between classic and trendy, 67% were in favor of classic over trendy. Yeah, you get this. You can go home and tell your church this. Between quiet and loud, 67% preferred quiet. Pastor, you won't believe what I heard. Now, I want you to take note of these. Maybe we can ask the question at the end. These last two are a little bit different. Between casual and dignified, 64% preferred casual to dignified. I think that one is tied to kind of the theme of authenticity and sincerity and so on. And then between modern and traditional, 60% preferred modern to traditional. Makes me wonder maybe about the terminology there or not. But anyways, and if you want me to send any of this to you, I'd be happy to do so. But again, this goes kind of against our assumptions about these things. Right? How often have we thought, well, the young people, they want it loud, they want an auditorium, privacy, trendy. These statistics seem to go exactly the opposite way. So what can we do about this? I think one of the things that we've done for a long time is we have assumed maybe a one-on-one outsourcing of relationships. Let me ask you some questions. Just feel free to kind of chime back on this. If you want your kid to learn baseball, where do you take them? To the coach, good. If you want them to learn piano, piano teacher, right? You want them to learn math? Not me, right? Don't take them to me. You take them to school. So you want them to learn spiritual things, who do you take them to? Youth pastor? Maybe the pastor, right? And so what we've done all of a sudden is we've outsourced everything, right? I want my kid to do this, I send them to that person. I want them to do this, I send them to that person. All of a sudden I just outsource everything for my child to somebody else and haven't really taken a whole lot of responsibility by myself. By the way, I certainly feel the weight of that responsibility. I have three boys, a 5, 3, and 1-year-old. And even at this age, when we do family worship, I feel the responsibility of needing to do them well in that area. So what can we do instead of that one-on-one discipleship? Well, surround them with a network of intergenerational relationships. All right, so all of a sudden, when a student walks through the doors of your church, they're not just being discipled by the youth pastor, kind of in an enclave or someplace separated from the rest of the church. When they walk in, they are being discipled by their Sunday school teacher, by their coach, by their youth pastor, by their pastor, their parent, a mentor that they have in the church, a friend. And all of a sudden, all of this kind of works together in a web and a network to keep them tied deeply into the Christian community. So you move from one-on-one relationships with your students to helping them realize that they are part of a community that's otherworldly, that's beautiful, that's powerful. And I think by really integrating them into the church, hopefully they will realize that they're part of something far bigger than themselves, right? Far deeper than themselves. Do kind of a thought experiment with me here. A student walks into the church, and they kind of know people from the community, and they watch as the custodian from their church or from their school is discipling the owner of the bank because the custodian has been a Christian for longer and showing them the ways of Christianity. Or they watch as people from different races or socioeconomic statuses sing the same praises to Jesus together, overcoming boundaries that outside of that church they have seen divide people. They all of a sudden are part of a compelling community that they weren't before, right? Not just another club or with a bunch of people that look like them. If you really want to do youth ministry for sustainable growth, I think it's simply this, is you focus on the gospel and you express it in a variety of different ways. Right, I have here a handful of different ways we can do this. We can live missionally, right? We show teenagers that everything that they do in every place that they go, they are living missionally, right? It's not so much go therefore, but as you go, or in all things, baptize them, right? Tell people about Jesus. Express your faith in Christ. It's in worldview apologetics. It's in the means of grace. It's in family discipleship. Or you might see down at the bottom there, means of grace. What does that mean? The means of grace are simply this. It is the ways in which Christ has built his church throughout history. It is things like service, the proclamation of the word, the ordinances, right? Simply doing what the Bible has told us to do. That is, I know I need the gospel, I need Bible, I need community in my youth ministry, but what type of methods am I using? Well, I'm doing the things that God has laid out before me. I am devoting myself to the apostles' teaching and the fellowship, or the breaking of bread and the prayers, all of which Acts 2:42 mentioned to us. So means of grace, apologetics. Maybe you hear that word a lot, right? Apologetics. We need to defend Christianity. But we need to do it in a way that's worldview, right? That integrates all of life. Youth are looking for more holistic answers to life questions. And I think this is where we need to make an adjustment. We tend to focus a lot on evidential apologetics, and we don't need to get into so much to like the nuts and bolts about this. But a lot of times we like to kind of give a quick answer to questions, and we don't always kind of give the bigger worldview, big perspective answer to the hard questions of life. So for example, when dealing with the story of Noah, we may give our students more archaeological proof for the flood. Right, that would be an evidence. And we need to do that. I'm not saying get rid of that, right? Go ahead and do that. But we also need to encourage them to think about what does it mean for God to divinely judge the world, right? That's part of Noah's flood as well. And that's a hard truth. God flooded the entire earth, right? Sometimes when we color in the picture with the rainbow, you know, and all that in children's church, we don't get the gravity of the situation there. But expressing to them, this is God's divine judgment because of the wickedness of the world. How do I make sense of that? And so leading them through that as well. Or another example, while talking about the claims of Christ, we have to give historical evidence concerning Jesus' historicity, right? Jesus was actually a person. Here's all the reasons you should believe in him. But we should also help students understand the exclusivity of Christ, right? That Christ compelled all people to follow him and that it was only through him that people could get to heaven. And how do I deal with that as well? Right, so we're trying to deal with all of those questions, and just frankly, that's not easy. Right? It's hard work, and it's going to require a lot of us to try to deal with that. And also intergenerational discipleship. The healthy ingredients of any child's spiritual formation are a godly family and the family of God. I mean, I can tell you, in the time that I've done youth ministry, with few exceptions, those that were growing healthy in the faith were people that were getting it at home as well. With few exceptions, were there children that were coming to church out of their own choice, out of their own decision. And I'm thankful to God for that. But so many of them that were successful and continued on into church, it's because they were getting it at home as well. So not only a godly family, but also the family of God, right? They need it in church as well. It's not either or, but instead of both and. The family needs the church, and the church needs the family. So when all is said and done, the youth pastor is at the center of that relationship, right? He's building a bridge between the two. He's able to encourage and exhort, or he can distract and deter. I think the youth pastor is providentially placed in a position that ought to bridge the gap between the home and the church, and he can bring those two places together. So for effective, sustainable youth ministry, I think the youth pastor has to make the most of that relationship, helping the church and home partner together, working together in tandem to see these young people grow in the faith. Here's the last thing. I think we need to give students roots to their faith. All right, we talked about the 11%, right? It was only 11% that said they had a deep faith that they walked away from later. The rest, right, the other 89%, they just had a shallow faith growing up. And so we need to give students roots to their faith, grow deep into their beliefs. At Welch College, where I work, our former history professor, Mr. Carter, who had retired a few years ago, shares a story. I love the story. I'm probably going to repeat it for the next few decades. but he talked about when he took his children on vacation, I think, down to Florida. He said up until that point, they had only ever had orange juice from concentrate. Anybody ever had orange juice from concentrate? Okay. All right. That's what we had growing up, right? You have this kind of this mushy kind of cardboard can, right? And you peel the top, it plops in the in the pitcher there, and you add water. It is, my mother would tell you, it's fiscally responsible, right? But it wasn't necessarily the greatest orange juice. So he says they go on their vacation, and their kids had been drinking that orange juice from concentrate their entire life. He says, you know what, on vacation, we're going to do something special. Told his wife, he said, honey, if you'll go out in the morning, just go ahead and buy the best orange juice that money can buy. I mean, Florida hand-squeezed orange juice. Money's no option. You know, spend everything that you want, right? And so she comes back, and as we hear that, right, personally, we're like, that sounds delicious, right? It's not even breakfast, but I'd love some orange juice right now. And he says that they sit down, they put the orange juice in front of it, and his son took a drink, and he said this. He said, my son said, what's wrong with the orange juice? He says, I want the other kind. What? Between concentrate and Florida hand-squeezed orange juice, he wanted the concentrate. And this is what Mr. Carter says. He says, we become accustomed to the cheap so long that when we taste the good tastes odd. So while he had flavorsome juice sitting in front of him, all he wanted was that metallic-tasting, mushy concentrate. My friends, we have the same decision when it comes to youth ministry. And I think this is really the key to growing sustainable youth ministry, is not opting for the cheap or for the easy, but giving them the good, right? Giving the stuff that takes work is difficult, it's hard, but so much more glorious and so much better for our students. I think this comes with the formulation of a biblical worldview. This will help change not only what students think, but also how they think. Youth ministers must equip students with the resources to think through ethical situations, theological problems, philosophical questions, and the like. This comes through biblical instruction that touches on every facet of life. I think the only way to do this, though, is to lead students deep into their faith, allowing them to root themselves deeply to Christ. If you'll forgive it, this is an entirely shameless plug for my book called Remodeling Youth Ministry. I try to cover a lot of this in the book, and so if any of this is kind of touched on this and you want to explore a little bit of it more, we'll have this available down the Welch College booth down there. But if I can send you a copy, I'd love to do so as well. I feel like with a lot of these questions, when we're talking about like our local churches, you know, so many of you know your own context, your own culture much better than I do. And that's not a way for me to opt out. I do think, though, that some of you know kind of the rate of which you can change. For some of you, you could go back right now and be like, we're going to do this, and your church should be all on board for it. For others, it's going to be the slow, kind of methodical change that's happening. So I think that's the first step, is kind of anticipating, like you're saying, anticipating rejections or hesitations, kind of thinking through those objections. And then from there, implementing some practices, maybe little bit by little bit, that they can start to see some change happening. I remember this. So when I was a youth pastor in North Carolina, I had this one student named Blake. Was just on fire for the Lord. I mean, just incredible zeal. Was always bringing his friends, really adamant about about Christ and bringing people in. But he also had kind of this idea that the way that we need to do this, this isn't really how he came to Christ, but he said the way we need to do this is kind of put on a big big hoopla about things, right? A big production about stuff. And so he said, you know, when they come in, can we do all this stuff to get them in? I said, Blake, how about this? I said, I'll make a deal with you. I said, how about I'm going to put you in charge of kind of being our welcoming committee. I want you to just love people when they walk in the door of our youth group so well that they don't want to go anywhere else. I said, if that doesn't work in, 6 months, we'll come back to this conversation. But I could tell right in that moment when I told him, like, I want you to be in charge of like loving, caring, compassionately caring for people. He's like, no, I'm already sold on this, right? Like, and so he wanted to do this in kind of this wisdom laden way of like, I'm not going to bring people to church by a production. I'm going to do it through the love of Christ expressed through my words and my actions. So I think a little bit by a little bit, but I think that can be contagious, right? So some of this sounds good right on the front, but it might take a long time to kind of implement in all areas of your youth ministry. So I tend to think that, especially teenagers, there's a whole lot of touchstones, there's a whole lot of bridges that we can make with teenagers between what they're experiencing in their culture and dissatisfactions that they have and what Christianity offers. I think they're looking for something deep, something that they can identify themselves with. I think one of the things, I think they want to have a rich doctrinal heritage as well. That might sound counterintuitive to us, but I think teenagers and young people want to know that their faith wasn't started a generation ago, but it's something that people have believed across all of time and space for the last 2,000 years, right? I mean, that's so much more compelling, right? I mean, I know personally, when I was in college, I took Friel Baptist History. And those that took it with me, we came out of that and we thought, this is a lot bigger than just us. And all of a sudden we're like, it's kind of cool to be Friel Baptist. You know, like we found it to be a compelling case for it, right? So yeah, I think showing like this is this rich heritage that's come down to us and we believe these things, not because we're the first ones to come up with it, but because people have been believing these things for two millennia, right? Yeah. I think the fact that they're asking questions assumes that they're looking for answers, right? doesn't mean that they're always going to like every answer that we give them, right? But we can make them as compelling of an answer as possible. Yeah. I would say over the last 30 years, youth ministry professionals have said that there's two major problems, boiled it down really to this, is lack of parental involvement, as well as churches separating youth ministry off as something kind of separate from the church. Now, if you want to ask, like, which one is more to blame, I don't know. I mean, it could be like 50-50, 60-40, whatever it is. I think those are the two major problems. And so you already have maybe a student that's not getting it at home, and then he goes into church and he's not involved with the rest of the church, but kind of only the small group over here. And so if we can, we need to fix both problems, right? But you know, maybe start with whatever's the lowest hanging fruit. We need to deal with both issues there. And that's not my plea for us to get rid of youth ministry. I mean, I teach youth ministry, so I think it's incredibly important. But I think there's a way to do youth ministry that involves the entirety of the church. They still have a youth pastor, you still have a youth and family pastor, but they're involved in the life of the church, they're being cared for, they're making relationships with other people in their church, and hopefully they're getting it at home as well. Good, oh yeah, okay, so I did this by accident. I was a youth pastor at a church in North Carolina, and I had the idea, I really wanted to increase family discipleship. So I said, you know what we're gonna do? We're gonna have a father-son baseball game. We're gonna take these boys to ECU baseball game. And the girls, put my wife in charge of it. They went in mother-daughter, like pottery painting class, right? We're like, and you go ahead and we'll kind of split them up for the day and we'll do those things. And then all of a sudden I had these parents come up to me, and I had moms, and this probably shows my ignorance more than anything, but I had a mom come up to me and say, hey, I don't have any daughters. Is there a girl that doesn't have, you know, mom at the church that would like to be like adopted for this event? And I had the same thing with dad. So I had dad come up to me and say, hey, like, I don't have any sons, but is there a guy that's here that doesn't have anybody that will take him to the baseball game? And with both of those parents, I said, absolutely. Like, it's my ignorance that provided this opportunity, right? But all of a sudden, we were able to promote this kind of intergenerational opportunity where they were adopted by people in the church, made to feel like a family, and they grew in kind of these relationships, and they had, you know, somebody kind of put their arm around them during a baseball game or be with them during pottery. The other one that we've done for a long time in different places is putting on, like, meals for different age groups in the church. So I've had teenagers put on a meal for the elderly class. And I make sure that we split them up like appropriately. So it might only be like two of the senior class and two teenagers per table. And I promise the teenagers, I say, you know, they've been around for a little while. They'll give you great dating advice. Okay. So they're like, yeah. But we promise the senior class, we say, hey, you know, you just show up. We want to treat you. You know, I'll buy the ham or the turkey, but the teenagers will provide the sides. And I got more thank you notes from our senior class for that event than anything else. And then the teenagers come back and say, you wouldn't believe how cool these people are, right? But part of it's that we've been kind of conditioned to just separate along those lines, right? To not communicate. And so just providing opportunities is probably more than anything, right? Looking for ways in which you can do that. Well, thank you all so much for being here.